Welcome to the Underwater Podcast, where we take a deep dive into the world of underwater portrait photography, cinematography, and everything in between. With me, your host, Brett Stanley. Welcome back to the Underwater Podcast, and this week I'm chatting with Underwater Director of Photography, Zach McCauley. Zach's career has taken him from assisting in his younger days to a sought-after stills photographer shooting underwater commercials for large brands, and now a cinematographer working out of his base in Brighton, England. We chat about his start in the industry, what kind of work he enjoys the most, and how different it is shooting stills as opposed to motion. Okay, let's dive in. Zach, welcome to the Underwater Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Brett.
How is it there? You're in Brighton, right? Which is south of London.
Yes. It's been unseasonably warm. The weather's been fantastic and beautiful. It's just been really uplifting of such a torrid time. But I've just listened to the weather forecast and they're forecasting snow on Monday. So you don't know where you are, but we're enjoying it while it lasts.
Yeah, nice. I mean, I've been to Brighton quite a few times and it's so beautiful. It must be in an amazing place when that sun's shining.
Brighton is, I think, the UK's most interesting town. And we moved here 10 years ago, my wife and three kids, well, now young adults, and we haven't regretted it for a moment. It's full of restaurants, pubs, clubs, bars, shops, a lot of independents, far more percentage-wise than anywhere else in the UK. So, you haven't got these huge chains, which makes it much more interesting. You've got the lanes and, of course, you've got the downs behind us, which is an enormous sort of area of natural beauty. And then you've got the sea, of course. So for me, it's everything. And you're 50 miles from London, which is important for work, obviously, if you have to go to see someone about a job or, you want to pop into London, it's within an hour's train drive.
Which is perfect because you've got the sort of type of work you're doing. You're between the ocean and you're probably close to the water tanks as well, like at the studios.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you've got the underwater studio in Basildon, which is, I would say, northeast London, and that's an hour and 20. And then you've got Pinewood U Stage, which is a little bit longer, but yeah, they're both get attable very easily. And I've got a few friends dotted around who have really nice swimming pools as well, with sort of 3 meter deep ends for tests or even sort of budget jobs.
Oh, see, this is good to know because the times that I've been in Brighton recently, I've been doing underwater photo shoots there, and I've rented a backyard swimming pool, and knowing that there's more than one in Brighton is very handy.
Well, I can surely help you next time you want to come here. It would be good to have a pint with you when the pub's open.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I kind of think I left a little bit of my heart in Brighton sort of 30 years ago when I first did the backpacking thing around the UK and Europe. And yeah, always love going back. So for you, like in terms of living there, are you shooting a lot in the open water there? Is it a good bit of the ocean to be shooting in for productions?
No, not at all. You wouldn't really choose to do that. There are some open sea jobs, productions that demand that. But the minute you put your dome under the waves, you're probably more likely than not be able to see very much.
Right. Yeah.
It's not the Red Sea or anything like that. There's a lot of backscatter, all kinds of stuff. It's a very healthy sea, but it's just not very, see-through.
Yeah. So if you do work there, it's mostly surface stuff.
Most of my work is in tanks now. I shoot for TV drama, movies, that kind of thing, in film tanks or swimming pools. My previous life was shooting wildlife for magazines when I was shooting more stills. That involves going to nice places, which are, where you've got great visibility.
Yeah. So was that underwater wildlife as well or above water?
Yeah, always underwater. Yeah, I've pretty much only ever done underwater throughout my entire career, so...
So how did that start? How did you get into the underwater world?
Well, my father was a Swanage man. Swanage in Dorset is Britain's premier dive town. It's the most gorgeous town, seaside town, next to Brighton, obviously. It's got some of the most incredible dives you've ever been to. A lot of war damage, a lot of ships, wrecks. They practice for D-Day there, so you've got lots of tanks lying off Pearl Harbor. You've got amazing reefs. Of course, you haven't got, you know, the colour and the visibility you've got in other parts of the world, but you know, being a Brit, it's pretty much top of the shop. And after that, I pretty much decided I wanted to be a photographer, and someone suggested, my hobby was scuba diving, and someone suggested I put the two things together. And then I thought to myself, who's the best person in the industry working? At the time, it was a guy called Mike Portelli. So I rang him until he was sick of me ringing him, and he eventually gave me a chance. And yeah. The rest is history, really.
So the pester worked.
Yeah, that was lovely. Don't get me wrong; he was the loveliest guy. Sadly, he's passed away now, but yeah, he was fantastic chap and totally the most innovative. You should check him out, Mike Portelli, the most innovative, incredible guy, right at the very beginning, the genesis of underwater filming and photography.
So was he doing like films and stuff like that, or was it still in the wildlife world?
He did a little bit of wildlife, but that didn't float his boat particularly. He just wanted to create pretty similar stuff to the stuff you're doing. But you know, he was doing it on film, just like I did when I started. And then he won several awards pretty quickly. He was actually a dentist, and he didn't have a huge amount of interest in scuba diving, but he was an artist, and he wanted a canvas to apply his particular art. And he quickly picked up a movie camera. He had a bit of money because he was a dentist, and dentists, you know, do quite well. And I think he just gambled a lot of the cash he had made, and I totally admire. And
yeah,
he went for it. He bought some expensive film gear. I mean, it's so old now, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was all film gear, as it were. And you should check his ads. They are insane. Really, really amazing stuff.
I mean, that's really quite inspiring, isn't it? When you kind of look back and think, you know, how easy we kind of have it now with digital stuff, and then look at the work people were doing back then with film.
Yes.
It's motivating.
Yeah, I mean, my first campaign for Diesel Jeans, Mike Portelli was actually offered the job, and he said, look, Zach, I can't do it. I'm busy. Do you want to do this? I said, yeah, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
So I hired a Hasselblad and a 220 back. So that gave me 20 shots, Brett. 20 shots, man.
Yeah.
And
no pressure.
Yeah. And the two-day shoot, one-day builds, one-day shoot. And I had to see, we didn't have Dig in those days. So I bought a 35mm Polaroid box. I don't know if you're familiar with this. I've still got it here. I'm looking at it. It's an antique piece now.
And is it the housing for the Polaroid camera?
No. What you do is you simply take a conventional 35mm film camera, you load it with the Polaroid film, which I believe has only 12 shots. I can't remember now. And then you shoot your 12 shots, and then you take it out, you open up the back of your 35mm housing and process the Polaroid film in this machine. And out comes a very, very tiny 35mm image. So you've got all these advertising executives from Lowe's looking at a piece of the most tiniest thumbnail, and you know, and they're going, yeah, okay, that'll do, yeah. Now go in. Go in with your 20 shots with your Hasselblad and shoot it slightly bigger, please.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about that, because I'm fascinated. So, was it like a little cartridge of kind of Polaroid film that would go into like your Nikonos or something?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly that. Yeah, it's like a cassette, of very similar to a roll film, and you would just put it in a normal way. And just, I think the other downside was it was about 50 ISO or less.
Oh, right. Yeah. So you had to pump the light into it.
Yeah. Well, you had to do a lot of, you know, you had to do a lot of imagining, shall we say.
Right. So how does that translate? So for anyone who's listening, like, back in the day when you shot with film, you would shoot with a Polaroid to kind of get an idea of what the scene and the lighting looked like. because you couldn't process your film there and then. So you're doing that underwater with this nifty little Polaroid thing. But if it's ISO 50, does that mean that you have to shoot the campaign on ISO 50 film?
No, not at all. I mean, you just do the maths, really. So, right. You know, you put in, if you may well decide to shoot at 100 or 200 film. I have to add the caveat that I only use this device once. But, yeah, so you just do the math. So you double it or if you make it to 400 ISO if you decide. But, of course, you know, you have to be careful of grain and so on. So I think I doubled it to 100. But this was a high-budget job, and we had a 20K with a generator pumping down through 3 meters of water. So actually there was quite a lot of light.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, 20K, that's a lot of – yeah, a lot of light coming in. And so how did it come out with your 20 pieces of film?
Well, you can see it on the website. It was interesting, most interesting job. It happened to be, I would think, one of the most interesting jobs of my career. It happened to be the very first one. It was a mafia hit, dead and dying people tied to concrete blocks in various stages of decomposition. From the very, at the very front, you've got someone who is minutes away from dying. Next to him, there is a lady who's obviously just expired. And then off into the distance, you've got poor souls who perhaps dead a couple of hours or even longer.
And then this is all in camera, so.
Yeah, absolutely all in camera. I got it. It was all done under health and safety HSE regulations, but I got it pretty much within 30 minutes. You haven't got long to do this stuff. It was about a month in planning and getting all the mannequins, because you've only got two live people struggling.
Right. That was my next question. Yeah.
If you look at the image, there's two human beings in the foreground. There's a man and a woman, and they are actually live, and they've got their hands tied behind their back, only they haven't. They've got a cylinder of spare air, which is a safety device. We had safety divers left and right, so the actors, when they required air, all they had to do was put their hand out. A safety diver would be feeding them air within 1 or 2 seconds. So they were all completely safe. But then going up back into the distance are these mannequins, which the agency dressed in diesel gear, and they made the figures more grotesque and more decomposed as they went back into the scene. And we got a child's bike in there and a shopping trolley, usual things you find in nasty places where mafia people want to dump bodies.
Yeah. I mean, it's an amazing effect. Like I did, until you sort of mentioned it, I was like, wow, you had like 12 talent on this holding their breath. Like that's pretty awesome. But knowing that they're now mannequins, it's quite impressive.
And you wouldn't be able to do that. It would be totally impossible, I think. You know, you'd have issues. You'd have issues, with the legal framework of how the shoot was set up. But I think two worked well.
Oh, so where was this shot? Was this actually shot in open water, or is this in a tank?
No, not at all. No, this was in a tank. I wouldn't choose to shoot in open water. I've only done, I think, one major job in open water in my career. You just need control.
Yeah. So with a shot like this, when you're trying to replicate, you know, like a murky swamp or whatever, do you sort of murk up the water? Are you adding particulate to the water to give you that depth? Or
yes.
Is the tank already like this?
Yeah. Well, that is another story. You know, we had to, yeah. But generally speaking, yes, you do, you may, in this case, you would certainly, it would be desirable to do that. Yeah. So you, in this case, we added a bit of Fuller's Earth. Now, you know, you can add things like small florets of broccoli. That's her favourite.
What does that do?
It just looks, it's perfect for just looking like bits of vegetation floating by.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
A couple of years later, just a funny story about this. I took the dead and dying dummies home, let them drain in the garden for a couple of weeks, and then one day I put them into the loft, and then we moved house and I took them to the dump. I had these four or five characters who were grotesquely, and you know, as you pop them through the aperture where they recycle the local recycle council tip. I think someone called the police. I never heard any more, but there was a lot of people looking rather shocked.
You could have a lot of fun with that, I bet, and get yourself into some serious trouble probably too.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So how does that work in terms of your relationship with Mike? Were you still working for him at this stage, or had you gone off on your own at this point and he was kind of starting to sort of pass work on your way if he couldn't do it?
Both, really. I mean, we all worked on a freelance basis. So he would ring you and say, look, I've got a job, can you make it? And I would be part of his team. If there was enough work to go around for certain, if it was a big job, he may, let's for argument's sake, need 8 or 10 people. But if it's a small job, you know, you may need four or something. So it depends how big the job was and you know, the demands of all that kind of thing. But yeah, I was quite young in those days, you know, I think without a lot of experience. So this was an enormous shot in the arm at that time.
Did that start to open doors for you? Was that like an inroads with the agencies to get more work?
Absolutely. It was a game changer for me, yeah. My jeans out. I mean, I literally hadn't done anything up until that time. I'd done a few, you know, bits and pieces, and I'd been on how to learn how to shoot underwater 4 or 5 times abroad with various groups, but I hadn't really done anything in the advertising world. And funnily enough, the advertising lady looked at a picture of a fish and said, "Yeah, you'll do."
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, you know, you have to kind of have that bit of luck, don't you? And then you're off and running.
Absolutely. So what did that lead to? What was the next sort of jobs that you did?
Oh, my God. I'm looking at my site now. It's quite a lot of different things. I mean, I went to a job for Sony, British Heart Foundation. I've done 2 campaigns for them, various pharmaceutical companies, Kelly Brook for the National Lottery, who's an actress. I think you know she's British. I've done jobs for Oxfam, for Boots the Chemist, for Merlin Entertainment, all their sea life centres. That was fun. It was like proper diving, only, you know, in their tanks. London Aquarium. I did a job for Guinness under ice. That was interesting. I think my favourite job of all of these that I've just mentioned was the British Heart Foundation. I call it Lawnmower Man. That was an interesting. I went there to answer a totally different brief. And when they knew I could shoot underwater, originally they just wanted me to shoot a couple kissing on beach, dry. And they said, "Oh, you do underwater?" So, yeah, fine. And the advertising agency people went into a huddle in the corner, drew something. And out came this guy mowing a lawn underwater. I said, "Can you do that?" And I said, "Yeah, of course I can." That job won several awards, I think. But it just goes to show how the nature of creativity can just be spur of the moment often.
Yeah, totally. And I definitely think that in sort of our genre, in our industry, that happens a lot, because I don't think people really, if they haven't done it before, they're not sure what's possible. And I think they either go too far and you're like, "Well, actually we kind of can't do that very easily," or they're really, you know, underestimating what's possible. Are you finding that when you're getting involved in these sort of productions that you're giving them ideas, that you're kind of spurring their imaginations to kind of do something that's a bit bigger and better than they had maybe thought of to start with?
Yeah, sometimes not. You know, you have two, you know, scenarios where they are very definite what they want, they know what they want, and they, you know, you're there to serve that purpose, which is fine. You can offer as many tips and solutions as you like and ideas, and they're often taken on board. And other times, you know, you're asked in, and most, as you may know, as you will know, most campaigns are devised and they have to be passed, don't they, by the client, signed off. So you've already got this very core idea which has to be replicated. So the amount that you can add is limited. You just shoot anything you like, which I don't think's ever happened.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, there is a. I did a job for Fitbit, which you can see on the site, which was very very much a bit more loose, and it turned out extremely well, I thought, where they were. There's a program on UK television called Strictly Come Dancing, which is really popular. And they wanted to mix the genre of Strictly Come Dancing and of people wearing Fitbit watches, you know, those devices that monitor your health. So we got a couple of very fit ballroom dancers who work for an amazing agency called Aquabetics, who could hold their breath for two or three minutes at a time. And we built us a very simple dance floor underwater and put some simple lighting in. And I just said, let's just go down there and just dance your heart out. And that's what they did. But whatever you do, put your wrist with the Fitbit as far forward as you can.
Right, yeah, push the product in. Yeah,
push the product in. And that works. I work very closely with a lighting gaffer called Neil Blackman, and I said to him, I just want it to look, you know, really razzmatazz, lots of spots going left and right and crisscrossing, and that was incredible, and he did that. So yeah, it often goes very much hand in hand with a lighting gaffer.
And I think this campaign, or at least when you posted it on your Instagram, was the one that kind of, I think, piqued my interest and went, oh, what's this guy doing? Just because of the style of the lighting and stuff. And you've got these, are they Astera tubes in the back there?
Yeah, actually, I just remembered it was a guy called, I think Bernie Prentice was in charge, and Neil was working with him on the day. So I don't want to do Bernie out of yeah. So they were his. That was his idea. So he had a couple of, what are they called?
Kino.
Yes, thank you. Kino Flows. So we just put, it was very simple. It was very low budget,
but very effective. Like the dance floor kind of area, and then you've got the blacked out pool behind, and the way you've lit it.
You know. I did a lot of retouching on that myself, actually, but only cleaning up the floor and maybe adding an extra beam of light. Those two tungsten sources that you can see facing the lens are, I think they're redheads, underwater redheads. So they're tungsten light source mixed with daylight light source and exposed for, you know, 5,600 Kelvin, which is daylight. So, those tungsten sources gave a nice warm feel.
Yeah, it's got very much a kind of that nightclub kind of stage kind of feel. And then the bubbles that are in the background, are they intentional, or have you just got a safety hanging out the back there? It seems, it looks like maybe you've got a bubble bar or something.
Absolutely, you got it. Bubble line, exactly, a bubble line. So we often use a bubble line. Just want to add a little bit of extra detail, bit of extra shape.
Yeah. So when you're using a bubble line or a bubble bar, how do you find them? Because the times that I've used them, you kind of have to use them very sparingly, otherwise they start to do horrible things to the water.
Yeah, I think the key is, you might be alluding to the size of the tank. I mean, this, if you were to use a smaller tank, you would, you know, the water might become milky quite quickly. Yeah. I don't know, possibly. But this is one of the tanks that I shoot in a lot, which is called the Underwater Studio in Basildon, and they are, it's an enormous tank, a 30 feet by 40 feet by 6 meters deep. So it's an enormous amount of water in there. So turn on a bubble line, it wouldn't cloud the water all day, even if you had it running all day.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. I think the times that I've done it, it's been definitely in a smaller tank, and you kind of get this roiling, bubbling water effect. And you definitely don't want it on all day.
No, not at all. I mean, it does go through the air as well. I mean, depending on if you have an umbilical, or we often will have several safety divers who, there has to be one dedicated to each actor talent, if you like. And then we'll have maybe one or maybe even two other divers rigging, helping, activating the bubble lines, moving lights about. You know, there could be, in this typical shot here, obviously myself, the two talent, you've got two safety divers. So that's two, four, it could be sort of six, seven, maybe even eight people in the water.
Including yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got two tanks there in the UK, the Pinewood and this one. Do you have a favourite between them? Do they have different characteristics that you kind of like?
Well, they're both different in various ways. One is in Pinewood Studios, so it's super famous, and it's, you know, it's used for major films, you know, like James Bond and all the rest of it. And obviously cost a bit more money to hire it. The Underwater Studio in Basildon also has big films, sometimes quite major as well, but it is a little bit, you know, a little bit less. But they both offer pretty much the same thing. And I love shooting in both. I have to be, if I'm honest, I've shot in the Underwater Studio a lot more. It often is dictated as to what the client's budget is. So you will get the scenario where they, you know, they will compare the two studios perhaps. And if their budget stretches, you know, then they will make a decision.
Right. Yeah.
That way or the other way. And, but they both offer pretty much the same thing, which is an enormous body of very clean water. Wide gantries, which is important. So you can put your lights pretty much 360 degrees all the way around. Overhead ladder beam on wheels, which is really important. So you can add lighting directly overhead wherever you like. But yeah, they, you know, they have green rooms, changing rooms, showers. They have canteens. You know, it's a proper place where a big production could just rock up, take over for the day, and get what they want.
Yeah, and be comfortable doing it.
Yeah, exactly. They're both really, yeah, they both offer slightly different services, but both excellent.
And then speaking of green rooms, and I know this is not the green room that you're referring to, but have you done much underwater green screen visual effects kind of work?
Yes, well, some for sure. There's the really interesting job I did called for the Goodman's Food Group, which is on the ads page, and it was for a company called Smack Deli. It's a brand of food which serves up high-class burgers and lobster burger. Right. Very delicious. And we had two young ladies dancing all day long in front of a green screen. And then I managed to persuade the advertising agency to use one of my stills from about 10 years before that I shot in the Red Sea with some cave light and some sunlight, you know, pinging past a rocky outcrop. And that, it just looked gorgeous. And they pinned lobster tails on the bottom half of both of the ladies.
Oh, so like they were actually swimming in lobster tails, or they did this in post?
Yeah, no, that was added later.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, but it was meant to look like an illustration as well.
Gotcha.
It wasn't supposed to be perfect because who the hell has a lobster tail, right? So
yeah.
So it had to be like that. The idea was it was conceptual.
Yeah.
More than anything else. But that I enjoyed that. That was a lovely one to work on.
How do you find working with the green screen? Does it take a lot to kind of dial it in to get the right effect?
Not at all. I mean, you have to, one of the biggest issues is getting one big enough that stretches the full 40 foot by 6 meters. And then you have to keep it really taut, and then keep it lit evenly, as evenly as you can. And that involves budget. So yeah, you have to persuade the client to pay for that if that's what they want. It's as simple as that, really.
And so, what's your convincing argument for them paying for that? Is it that they're going to save money by being able to do whatever they want in post rather than trying to spend days trying to get the image right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess you know, it's all down to what they want, what the creative vision of the creative who's dreamed up this, you know, the idea. Yeah. And then if they really want to fulfill their creative vision and they really want to go underwater, they may come to someone like me and I will say, well, in my opinion, this is the only way to achieve what you want to do. And then there'll be a supermarket cart of prices. So if you want to add the green screen, it'll cost an extra such and such. If you want to, you know, add an even light spread from left to right, top to bottom, it'll probably be an extra amount. Sometimes they just don't have the budget and corners are cut. And you can make allowances for some corners being cut, as you know, but in digital it's easier. But there are limits to the corners that can be cut, and after a bit you have to kind of inform them that perhaps they may want to think about going down another route that's more budget orientated, shall we say.
Yeah, totally. And so what percentage of your work is stills versus motion? Because I know you do both. Did you start off with stills and then move into motion, or were you always doing both?
Yeah, the first one, exactly. So pretty much only stills for 20 odd years. And then stills in the UK anyway, I don't know, but it's like in the States, but it's become harder and harder to make a living out of at the sort of high end level. So, and perhaps there was an element of me wanting to find a new challenge. And so I bit the bullet and bought myself a really nice system, a Gates deep weapon housing with a red Epic Dragon and a couple of lenses and all the chutney that goes with it. And it was a bit of a stretch financially, but because of all the jobs I've been pumping studios way, I called up managers and said, look, do you mind if, could you help me out next time you have a film job? Could you at least put me forward for it? And they were very kind, and that's what they did.
So in terms of the studios and the agencies you were working for doing the stills, you were like, you know, if you ever have some motion stuff coming up, can you give me a go at it?
Is that what you're saying? Well, exactly. Pretty much, as I said in the first instance, you know, if you could kindly see your way clear to put my name forward. And then I already work. I think a lot of this is you have to have a great web designer. And I've got a great web designer. His name is Andy Eaves, everyone. Andy Eaves, yes. And he and I have been working forever together. And he helped, a really well-constructed website which shows people clearly what you can do and what, you know, how people can achieve their dreams. Then I think that helps a lot. And I was able to use a lot of my still stuff to bolster my film stuff. And I think a lot of film companies quite like that because it showed that, you know, I was reasonably creative, I suppose, and could follow a brief and make it look fabulous, which is what everyone wants.
Right? And they're wanting to see and kind of take your stills work and kind of make it move.
Exactly. I mean, it's a different discipline, as you know, but, you know, it's not a million miles away. So, yeah, you have to think in scenes and, you know, you have to learn the menus and understand a lot of the new concepts with a movie camera. But at the end of the day, you know, basically it is fairly similar. I think it's harder. I think it's actually harder than stills in some ways.
Because with
a still, you've got a split second and that split second can look incredible or not so good. But you'll shoot hundreds of pictures in a day. So you will get 10, 20 absolutely incredible shots. But with a film, all you need is for one actor to slip up, maybe move slightly in the wrong way, or you to, you know, do something amiss with the camera, maybe not track quite as well as you wanted to. And you have to retake the whole scene. And you can only do X number of scenes in a day, of course. So you've got far less chance to get that money shot. So you have to be much more concentrated, I think, with film.
I definitely agree. And because I've gotten into film and motion work more in the last few years. And it is that sort of thing where, you know, as a photographer, you're kind of looking at every angle all the time. You know, you're like, I'm going to take that shot, I'm going to take this shot, I'm going to take that shot, and we'll work out later on which one works. Whereas with motion, you've got to do your push in or your pan or whatever perfectly every time. You can't kind of second guess yourself halfway through. You've got to commit to it. And then if the slightest thing goes wrong, or, you know, you bang into the wall and you shake the camera or whatever, you know, you've got to start again. And it takes so much time. It's a total mindset, like you say.
Yeah, no, exactly. And you've got an enormous amount of money and people on the surface, you know, looking at the director's monitor and scrutinizing it. You've got, you have comms. So we always have comms. So they can talk to us through a hydrophone. So we can hear instruction, which I encourage my clients, the director, the producer, whoever wants to grab hold of the mic to communicate continuously. I think it's so important. It's when they go quiet, then you kind of think, oh, okay.
Yeah, this is either a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, exactly. So if they're communicating, even if it's, you know, you could do a different take slightly better, that's fantastic. So you say, okay, fine, then they maybe wants me to push in a bit or zoom out or go in for a close-up, which is fantastic. So they've told me that. That's perfectly understandable, and in we go. So that's great. So communication is the key.
Yeah. How do you feel about Do you prefer having direction, or do you like being told to just go and, you know, see what you can get?
No, I think the first one. It's safer. I mean, you have a, unless it's a personal project, you know, where you can really stretch your legs and it's up to you. And if you fail, which isn't likely, if you've probably thought about it for ages, no, there's no financial penalty. But in this case, if you don't get the shot, then there's an awful lot of budget at stake, and your reputation at stake. So I like to think that I follow a brief really closely and listen to brief very closely as well. I did a job a few weeks ago, which I can't tell you about because I've signed an NDA, but there was like a 3-hour gap between me going in the water, and every minute of that 3 hours, I was concentrating on physical movements in my head, how I do this, what focal length, what, you know, where I'd be and how it would look, how fast the actor is swimming overhead and so on. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So for that 3 hours while something else was happening, you're kind of practicing and perfecting.
Well, I couldn't go in the water.
So oh, I see. Yeah.
I didn't explain that. My apologies. No, I wasn't allowed in the water. I only had like 30 minutes to get the shot. So I was sitting in a room dry.
Yeah.
And in my head, going through the movements, but the principle's the same. So you have it made that going through the movements in my head may be a factor for a few weeks before a big job. So I'll be thinking about every movement, every part, every camera setting, making sure I've got every base covered.
Yeah, so that when you get on set, you can just basically do your job and be as efficient as possible.
Have you heard of the phrase the SAS, train hard, fight easy?
No, I haven't heard that one.
Train hard, fight easy. Yeah, the SAS motto. It's brilliant, and you know, you've got to prepare, absolutely prepare everything, and then it looks effortless, hopefully, on the day.
Well, I think the one that I know, and I do a lot of carpentry, is measure twice, cut once. Which
excellent.
Yeah.
My son's 19. He's training to be a carpenter.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, you can tell him that one. Okay. The amount of times that I've measured once and cut three times is too many times.
Costs a lot of wood.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that you say that, though, because I had a job recently where, you know, we were doing shooting a music video on a beach, and the brief for me was, you know, in a few hours' time, you're going to get in, you're going to go in the water with the talent and just do some nice kind of floating around stuff. So that's what I prepared for. And, you know, I pull up in the car park at the beach, thinking that I've got probably 2 hours to prep and get ready. And they're like, you know what? The director's changed his mind. Can we get you on the beach now? You're going to run down the beach behind the talent with the camera into the water and do this single take, you know, out past the breakers.
Yep.
And I'm like, oh, my God. This is not going to work. And you just have to make it work, you know what I mean? And hope that what comes out the other end is usable.
Yeah, and this is common. I mean, on a film set, you know, a director, if you're shooting for television, you probably have two takes at maximum, then they'll want to move on. So you just have to be on the tips of your toes, on the balls of your feet, ready to go. You have to be straining every sinew to listen to when you're going to be called in, just like your experience. You may have a minute, 2 minutes to prepare. Get in the water, Zach. You know, the actors are ready to turn over. So you know, you have to have a really good team around you. You know, great assistant, make sure the camera's ready, got a fresh battery. You know, the media's got enough space on it. You've got enough air in your tank. You know, you can't really sit down and just talk to your mates about the weekend.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, that was the thing with this job was that, you know, as I'm heading to the beach to start my run, I realized that for some reason the focus ring, I can't pull focus on this camera. So luckily it's got autofocus. Yeah. So I managed to be able to use that. But it was that moment of, oh my God, I'm just going to crap my pants.
Yeah.
How do I tell everyone to stop so I can open this thing up and fix the problem, you know?
No, exactly. Well, that it is a lot to go wrong on underwater systems. We both know that. I've had that a few times, you know, where, you know, the motor's gearing slips out of sync with the lens and, you know, and everyone's ready.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're going, oh my God, I can't focus. You have to be honest. You have to surface. You have to say, look, very sorry. It will be 5-10 minutes, but we have to realign the focus rings. I've since then, by the way, had some engineering done, and I use new focus motors. No, the ARRI C-Force motors, which are excellent. But anyway, so yeah, that problem has been fixed. Everyone.
Yeah, just everyone listening. Yeah, it's all good. So, I mean, you say that you invested in this camera system for your business. Was there a reason that you ended up doing that rather than just renting?
Yeah, I think so. You have it at home. You can look at it. You can size it up, play with it. You can make adaptations. You may have an idea in the middle of the night. You can go down and tinker with it. You learn it. So if you hire it, of course, it's probably going to be, you know, a fantastic bit of equipment, but it may not be. You know, it may have been caned on the last job. You just don't know. Nobody knows. You know, someone may have hired it out to someone who is not au fait with working underwater very well. And there may be something that's damaged and they haven't owned up to it and no one spotted it at the hire place. And, oh, man, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of things. There's enough problems we both know aren't there to contend with without having choinky gear, which you're not super confident is going to work 100% of the time. We'll call it 99% of the time. You can never have 100%.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In terms of your business, does it make more sense, and does it get you more work owning the equipment as opposed to renting?
I think it does. You know, you can offer deals, which are nearly always requested. So yeah. people will try to get a deal from you. So you when you estimate, you may want to build in a 10% margin or whatever. I don't know. It's up to everyone's business model, how they wish to perform. But I mean, all this stuff is not exactly news to anyone. But yeah, I think you can offer. You may have a talented director that you have been dying to shoot for, and he or she may have very limited funds, and you want to do the project. So if you own the gear, you can say, yeah, sure, that's fine. Let's do it. I can't wait to do it. You know, you are an insanely talented person and I really want to work with you. But that option isn't open to you if you hire it.
No, because then you've got to pony up if you want to play. It's that pay-to-play kind of thing.
Yeah, you have to pay the full rate, you know, the full whack, whatever the company wants. You have to pay that and you haven't got any wriggle room with the price.
No, exactly. Yeah. So if someone's looking to get into this sort of work, whether they're a dry cinematographer or if they're a stills photographer, what's your advice for them to sort of get into this industry to start working on commercials and features and short films?
Oh, my gosh, that is the question I'm asked daily.
So you know the answer then?
No, I still don't know it. I think it's different for every human being on the planet. I think Howard Hall wrote a really great piece which I was handed by a friend, which I save now. So when assistants ask me that exact question, I email it to them. And it's very long, and often they don't read it. And then you know that they're not going to make it because, A, they haven't read it. B, they probably haven't got the drive and ambition. But I think you just have to want it so much. You have to have various attributes, of course. You have to be, you know, handy with a camera and creative and artistic and be a great diver and everything else, but you just got to want it more than anything else. And you've got to be a team player. Film, unlike stills, is much more of a team game. So you have to build up a really great team, you know, a lighting gaffer, assistants, safety divers, all sorts of people, and they've got to like you. You know, you can't be, you know, an antisocial type. You have to be reasonably pleasant enough for them to want to work with you as well. So there's quite a few little elements that go with being a success. But I'm not saying I'm one, but you know, at least I'm still working after all these years, folks.
Well, I think that is a measure of success. You know, you're still doing what you love, and I think that in itself is kind of priceless.
Yeah, I mean, it is completely. It's a privileged job. People sometimes, when you meet them and they ask you what you do, if you don't know them, and you have to decide whether you tell them, because if you tell them, they often say, sometimes I'll just walk away because I don't believe you.
That's right. Yeah, that's not a job.
No, you meant to say insurance, didn't you? That's what you do. Yeah, that's right. Sell insurance. That's it. It's easier, isn't it?
I mean, there is a kind of, with this style of work, there is a kind of there's a cool factor, I think, especially for people who don't know about it, that they're like, you do what? Oh my god, that's incredible, tell me all about that, you know. I mean, that's why I have a podcast, for to tell people all about it, you know. And it is such a thing that there is not a day where I work and I don't kind of get a little giggle thinking that this is what I do for a job.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, it's insanely, it's like a drug, isn't it, Brett? You know, you have that fear in your heart that things might go wrong. So you train hard, find easy, like we explained earlier. But when you're on set doing it, it's just like nothing, no other experience you'll ever have, isn't it? I mean, it's insane. Yeah. It's really, really amazing. And I'm like you, totally honored. I feel honored that I'm still doing it. My wife puts up with a lot. She, you know, I think you need, oh yeah, I have to say, you really need a good partner. You know, someone who's understanding, you know, when you, a shoulder to cry on and someone to slap you on the back and say, well done as well, you know, both things.
Yeah, exactly. Does she work in the industry at all?
No, she's got a sensible. She's not doing that. No, she works for an advertising agency in Hove, around the corner from Brighton. So, I suppose it's related, but it's nothing to do with what I do.
Yeah, it's adjacent.
Yeah, adjacent, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, because my wife is in the film industry. She's a hairstylist and she works on, you know, big feature films and stuff. And yeah, so we do have, you know, kind of pity parties and kind of talk about all the stuff that's gone wrong and kind of try and outdo each other with how bad our day has been.
Well, I think the secret to a successful marriage is try not to talk about your work at all.
Yeah,
it's difficult with you, but for me, and I know my wife, Fliss, my lovely, ever patient, beautiful wife would probably say that I talk about it all the time.
Right, yeah. Possibly too much, Zach.
Too much, yes.
Yeah. Zach, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your story and just sort of and giving some insight into what you've been doing.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed every minute.
We'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And as always, if you like the podcast, please subscribe, review, and share. If you'd like to support the production of these episodes, you can purchase our very cool merchandise at theunderwaterpodcast.com. We've got branded coffee mugs, stickers, beer cozies, and posters featuring our amazing illustration and logo by Joe Hodenow. If you'd like to connect with us or learn more about our guests, you can reach us at theunderwaterpodcast.com or on Instagram. We also have a Facebook group where you can discuss the episodes and even get your questions answered by the guests. There's a link to it in the show notes. You can learn more about my underwater photography workshops and mentoring at brettstanley.com or Brett S. Photo on Instagram. The Underwater Podcast is presented and produced by me, Brett Stanley, and our music is Neo by Oh Boy. Keep creating, everyone. I'll see you in the water.